In the 3 decades this program has been on the air, we've talked about science and math and history and literature and education policy and theory. But not today. Today, we're talking show tunes.
I didn't know that Stephen Sondheim had written them. I didn't even know who Stephen Sondheim was. But it was those lyrics that captured me.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll talk to the author of the Stephen Sondheim Encyclopedia. We'll also spend an academic minute wasting food. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. If you make a list of the most important names in American culture in the latter half of the 20th century, Stephen Sondheim has to be right near the top. When he received the Presidential Medal of Freedom in 2015, President Obama said, put simply, Stephen reinvented the American musical. Now there is a marvelous new collection detailing the composer's remarkable output called the Stephen Sondheim Encyclopedia, written by Rick Pender. Pender has written for City Beat, which is Cincinnati's alternative newsweekly, since it was founded in 1994. He was the newspaper's arts and entertainment editor and is currently a contributing editor, reviewing local theater productions. Pender is past chair of the American Theater Critics Association and was the executive editor and publisher of Everything Sondheim and managing editor of the Sondheim Review. I asked Rick Pender why he took on this fairly daunting project.
I had a long foundation, I guess, of increasing fandom for Stephen Sondheim's musicals. And then starting in the late 1990s, I became a contributor to a quarterly magazine about Sondheim called the Sondheim Review. And then that evolved into me becoming its editor in 2004, which I did for a dozen years. It ceased publishing for some business reasons in 2016. And then I got approached by a publisher who said, would you think about doing a Stephen Sondheim encyclopedia? And I thought, well, you mean you want me to coordinate a bunch of writers? And they said, no, we want you to write it. And I said, okay. Then they sent me a contract asking me to provide 300,000 words. And after I, you know, recovered from my fainting spell, I said, okay, I'll give it a try. And I did. It took me about 18 months to put it together.
Well, besides the contract, this is obviously a labor of love. How did you discover Sondheim?
It began actually before I even knew who Sondheim was. I was a teenager, and the first LP that I ever obtained was the original cast recording for the movie of West Side Story. And I was just totally captivated by some of the wonderful lyrics. I didn't know that Stephen Sondheim had written them. I didn't even know who Stephen Sondheim was. But it was those lyrics that captured me. And then over time, I became increasingly aware of the surprisingly diverse array of lyrics and music that he had written, became more and more aware during the 70s when he had a number of major shows on Broadway, which were all strangely different from one another. But again, fascinated me. So I just sort of continued to build on that. By the 70s and early 80s, I was well aware of who he was.
And of course, Mr. Sondheim is still with us. Did you get cooperation from him while doing this book?
Yes, and that was actually my foundation for that, was editing the magazine about him. We sent him the magazine, and he, with some frequency, would send back comments, corrections, arguments, whatever occurred to him that we would then publish subsequently. And then once I started work on this book, there were moments when I felt I needed more information, more clarity, and I would ask him questions, and in a few cases, shared with him the entry, particularly the biographical entry that I have put together. I wanted to be sure it was very accurate, and so he read through all that and made some suggestions.
Well, as a young man, Sondheim had a relationship with Oscar Hammerstein. Could you tell us about that relationship in his life and how important it was?
Yes, very much so. Sondheim's parents divorced when he was a young teenager. He and his mother moved to Doylestown, Pennsylvania, and he didn't have the best relationship with his mother. He still had some relationship with his father, but his father remained in New York City, and so he was rather remote from that. Doylestown, Bucks County, Pennsylvania, is a pretty rural area, but a farm nearby happened to be owned by Oscar Hammerstein, as in Rodgers and Hammerstein. Sondheim had met Hammerstein's son, Jimmy. They became friends, and Sondheim started hanging around the Hammerstein homestead. There were lots of other people hanging out there. Richard Rodgers' daughter was there frequently, but Sondheim in particular warmed to Oscar Hammerstein's willingness to be a mentor. Sondheim was very interested in music as a composer and in writing lyrics, and Hammerstein, of course, was the lyricist half of Rodgers and Hammerstein. Even as a teenager, he had started writing shows. He wrote a school show, which he shared with Oscar, and said, because he now says he thought Oscar would look at this and say, well, this should be on Broadway. It wasn't really quite that good. But Oscar offered to tutor him in how to be successful in writing for the musical theater and set for him a series of exercises that Sondheim undertook while he was finishing high school and then in college at Williams College in Massachusetts. None of those shows ever saw the light of day beyond amateur productions at the school or at the college, but they were great exercises for him and really laid the foundation for his subsequent career. The other thing about Hammerstein is that he also pointed Steve in the right direction on more than one occasion. Steve was very eager to be both a composer and a lyricist, but one of the first opportunities that came his way was the writing of those lyrics that I liked so much for West Side Story. He was not certain that he wanted to do that. He wanted to compose, but Hammerstein said to him, oh, come on, the opportunity to work with Leonard Bernstein and Arthur Lawrence and Jerome Robbins, who were already part of the creative team for that show, he said, those will be fabulous connections for you and you should do this. And that eventually that proved to be very true. The second show that Sondheim worked on was Gypsy, with Arthur Lawrence again writing the book and Ethel Merman starring in the show. And she did not want some green unknown composer working on the show, even though Arthur Lawrence had offered Sondheim's services up. Instead, she turned to Julie Stein, who was a pretty well-established theatrical composer at the time. And Sondheim, again, came on board as the lyricist, sort of grudgingly. And again, Oscar said to him, you know what? This is a great opportunity for you to write for a known star and tailor music to her persona, to her voice, and that sort of thing. Sondheim had a great time doing it, and so he learned some lessons that served him very well working in the future with other well-known performers like Angela Lansbury and Bernadette Peters, and people like that.
Going back to West Side Story, later on he said he was somewhat embarrassed by some of those lyrics, didn't he?
He did. He and Bernstein had rather different ideas of the kind of music the show should have. Bernstein, very romantic, wanted very lush music and that sort of thing. He saw this as a love story, even though it was a tragic love story. Sondheim is a little more low-key about things. And so the lyrics that he wrote, he felt needed to be a little less exotic and emotional. The example that he frequently cites is, I feel pretty. He said, stop and think about it. This is a young immigrant girl from Puerto Rico. Do you think she would really be making up rhymes about I feel so pretty and witty and gay? And, you know, he said that's just not the way she would talk. But already the lyrics were written. He had written them, and Bernstein loved them. Lawrence loved them, and Jerome Robbins, who was directing the show, loved them. So Sondheim got outvoted and was stuck with him. He said he still blushes when he hears that purple prose that was in the lyrics there and in several other numbers.
Is he involved at all with the Steven Spielberg revival, the new movie?
Yes, that appears to be something that's keeping him quite occupied at age 91. He's the only survivor of that creative team. The rest have all passed on. But he is consulting with Spielberg on that project.
When he did Sweeney Todd, I read where he had a very different idea of what that play was about than the director did. Was there a clash there, or did it just kind of meld and work well?
I wouldn't call it a clash. There was probably some artistic difference over it. Harold Prince, a well-known director who worked with Sondheim on many shows, had a much grander scale in mind. He wanted to see that story as a sort of condemnation of the impact of the Industrial Revolution on life in England, and that was what had corrupted this man and turned him into a serial killer, essentially. Sondheim had actually seen a play in London by another writer that was what inspired him to be interested in this. And his notion was that he wanted to create a very scary musical that would just frighten people with how evil Sweeney Todd is. Hal Prince kind of overruled that, and they went ahead. And it was a fabulous production. It won Tony Award, very memorable production. But there have been subsequent productions of Sweeney Todd that Sondheim has liked very much, also on a much smaller scale, much more intimate. There was one just a few years ago that originated in London in a pie and mash shop there, not unlike the one that Mrs. Lovett operates in the show, although that they probably had a higher grade of meat in their meat pies. But it was done in this little, it was like a little fast food restaurant. And so everybody was very intimate with the cast, and it did very well in London. It moved to a slightly larger location. And eventually there was a production mounted in a very similar vein in New York City. It was on a theater stage, but very much in a way that resembled the interior of this pie and mash shop.
Is Sondheim uniquely a quote-unquote show tune writer? I mean, really, if you take a look at it, there's really been very few big hits of his songs.
He is. And part of the reason that he is unique, for one thing, is that he is both a composer and a lyricist. Usually, that's two people. Usually, it would be Rodgers composing music and Hammerstein writing lyrics, or Kander writing lyrics and Ebb composing the music. So that makes him somewhat different. But the other thing that really, I think, sets him apart is that he lets the story of the show begin to develop. He works very closely with the book writer, and because the book writer is not writing lyrics, often with like Rodgers and Hammerstein, Hammerstein was writing the book for the show also, based perhaps on a play or something like that. But with Sondheim's shows, since he's writing the music and the lyrics, he has a book writer who is very important to him. And he's had a handful of them. He still credits most of them as being the source of the stories that he's telling in his shows. And he often waited until the script was pretty well advanced before he would begin to create music. Then they would find opportunities to expand upon characters or events or motivations that were needed, and he would create the music for that. And so that very much, I think, sets it apart. It is also, though, why sometimes it's a little hard to extract music from his shows, because the music is so fully integrated into the storytelling. Not to say that he doesn't have a lot of music that's become pretty familiar over the years, because his shows have been produced and revived and seen over and over again, and people have become more and more familiar with many of the melodies.
Yeah, you just can't see, like, you know, the Dave Clark Five going to him and saying, write us a hit, would you?
Right, right. He often says, you know, his best known song is Send in the Clowns from A Little Night Music. And that became best known not because of the show particularly, although it was created for a very specific moment in that show, but rather because Frank Sinatra did a pop recording of it, and then Judy Collins did, and it was a Grammy Award-winning song of the year back in the 1970s.
Still to come, our conversation with Rick Pender continues with a look at how Sondheim fared when he tried to write book for a show. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to The Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett, and our guest is Rick Pender, author of The Stephen Sondheim Encyclopedia. Sondheim's fame came as a composer and lyricist, but I asked Pender if he ever tried writing the book for one of his shows.
He did not. Sweeney Todd is perhaps the best example. He saw this production of a play in London that he liked very much. Christopher Bond was the playwright, and he approached Bond and said, "I'd like to turn this into a musical." And it was Sondheim's notion initially that he was going to write the book for it. He was very enthusiastic about it. But as he started working on it, he said he got through a couple of scenes and it was already an hour's worth of material. And he said, you know, there's no way that I'm going to be the right person to write the book for this and then, you know, compose the music and the lyrics. So then Hal Prince, who was directing it, turned to Hugh Wheeler, who they had already worked with on A Little Night Music. Wheeler had written the book for that. He came on board and created the book for that very successful show.
If a young music student comes to you and says, I would love to study Sondheim, where should I start? Where would you steer them?
Oh, golly. I think that I would tell them to really, well, here, I'll tell you this. This is sort of how I really expanded my appreciation of him. There is a three-disc recording set called Collector's Sondheim. It's three discs. It was released in 1985, and it has a great cross-section of music from the various shows that he had written up to that time. So it would take, you know, maybe 3 hours to listen to that. Listening to that, you will get an incredible sense of the vast array and the spectrum of music that he has composed and written. And I think that would be a great introduction for a student.
We all have our opinions. What would he say is his masterpiece?
I think that he would probably say that based on public reception and critical reception, that Sweeney Todd would be the one. And that's the one that's sort of commonly thought of as his greatest work. It is through composed. That is, it is got music from start to finish, like a movie. It has underscoring of scenes and that sort of thing. So it is a magnificent accomplishment. But he has other shows. I mean, he sort of laughs about Into the Woods, a very popular show. In fact, many, many more productions of it than almost any of his other shows. In fact, in some years, there are more productions of Into the Woods than of all of his shows put together, probably because it's based on fairy tales. So it's subject matter that people are somewhat more familiar with. And so that show has provided a very steady revenue stream for him. Now, does that make it a masterpiece? I don't know. I think that every one of his shows, though, have enough about them, at least the majority of them, that can be said, you know, these are masterful compositions. And it really depends on what your criteria are for defining a masterpiece. I will tell you that he often points to a song that he wrote for Pacific Overtures as his favorite song. Maybe, I don't know, that he wouldn't use the term masterpiece, but it's a song that he feels really, really worked well. It is a song from three different perspectives of people. The Pacific Overtures is the story of Japan being opened up to the larger world by Admiral Perry in the 19th century. And this song called Someone in a Tree, there are three people observing the parties meeting in a treaty house on a beach in Japan. An old man who is recalling his experience doing it, a young boy who is probably the young boy who was that man when he was older. He's up in a tree watching. And then there is a samurai who is sort of like a security guard who is under the floor of the house listening to people talking. They are each hearing snatches of conversation that don't always make a lot of sense, but they all coalesce into a wonderful portrait of what this negotiation was all about. So I would say that that's one that he points to as something that he's very proud of.
When life is normal, it's not now, right. How many productions are ongoing of his at any given time? I mean, it's got to be massive.
Yes, it is. When I was editing the Sondheim Review magazine, we ran listings of productions. It was a quarterly magazine, so we sort of tried to cover the next 3 months. And I would say it was not unusual that there would be easily 150 to 200 productions of shows. Again, Into the Woods, very frequently produced, but many others also. And sometimes it depends on the moment in time. I mean, a funny thing happened on the way to the Forum is a popular show. It's a, you know, sort of raucous comedy, probably the funniest of his shows. It's the show that had the longest Broadway run of any of his productions. And that one is frequently produced. You have to have the right performers to pull it off, but that's a good one. And then there are opera companies that are producing his shows. Sweeney Todd has often been produced in more operatic things. The other thing I will mention is that there are international productions. There have been productions of his shows in countries all around the world, and in many cases translated into their native languages. No small feat for the words that Sondheim has composed, but pretty successfully done in a number of places.
I was going to say, how do you translate those rhymes and make them rhyme?
I don't know. I've not ever seen any of those productions, so I can't answer that for you. But I know that it has been shows have been produced in Germany, in Sweden, in Japan. So there are people who endeavor to do that and apparently do so with some success.
Well, you spoke a little bit about he's working with Spielberg on the West Side Story movie. Is there anything? Is he up to anything else at, you know, the ripe old age of 91?
The last several years, he has been working sporadically on a new musical based on two films by Luis Buñuel, an avant-garde director from Portugal. These will be very strange shows. They are both about people who are trapped in a dining room at a dinner who are having a hard time getting along with one another. So he has thought that this created an interesting dynamic. It is not a show that would be on Broadway. I would imagine at best it would be an off-Broadway production. It has apparently had a couple of workshops, but it is seems to be stalled at the moment. He was working on it with a playwright, David Ives, who then decided that it wasn't right for him. And so he stepped away. And I have heard that Sondheim has perhaps found another writer to do some work with on it. But I think he's been very involved with that West Side Story movie. He's quite willing to consult with people who are doing important productions of his shows. There is a production of Company that was staged by the British director, Marianne Elliott, in London about 3 years ago that switched the gender of the central character of Company. The original play is about a 35-year-old man surrounded by his married couple friends who are all trying to urge him to get married. And this production that Marianne Elliott has directed has changed Robert to Bobby, spelled B-O-B-B-I, and it is a woman. And it provides for some interesting new insights and twists in the story. Instead of having three girlfriends, as Robert does, Bobby has three boyfriends, and so on and so on. Sondheim is always careful to approve dramatic changes like these to his shows. But when he works with a director who he admires, he really feels that it can bring new insights into his works.
Again, the name of Rick Pender's new book is The Stephen Sondheim Encyclopedia. It's published by Roman and Littlefield and is available on their website. The amount of food that goes to waste, not just here but around the world, is not only remarkable, it's also the topic of today's Academic Minute.
How do we waste less food? I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of the Association of American Colleges and Universities. And today on the Academic Minute, Beth Feingold, associate professor in the School of Public Health, explains how a lot of food waste happens before it gets to the store.
When you think about food waste, you might imagine leftovers rotting in your fridge or apple cores tossed in the trash. But over half of the 62.5 million pounds of food lost and wasted in the U.S. each year occurs before it even gets to your doorstep. And most of that food waste is actually wasted food. That is, food tossed for reasons having little to do with how good it looked or tasted. This wasted food means wasted resources like money, labor, water, land, energy, and nutrients. It means accelerated climate change and ultimately comes at a cost to public health. Around the country, food recovery programs redistribute good food that might otherwise be wasted to hunger relief organizations like food banks and food pantries in efforts to jointly address hunger, food security, and environmental sustainability. However, little research has quantified the impacts of these efforts on the environment and human health. This is what my team, including key community partners, has set out to do in New York's Capital Region. Focusing on fresh fruits and vegetables, which have high nutritional value and account for 40% of all wasted food, we're asking questions like, do interventions such as donation-based tax incentives effectively lead to reduced greenhouse gas emissions and improve access to nutritious foods in food pantries? And how might these interventions impact health outcomes among food pantry clients? More recently, we're asking, how is the COVID-19 pandemic challenging both food access and food recovery and redistribution efforts? While we recognize that systemic changes are needed to address the entrenched issues of waste and hunger, my team and I hope that our efforts to fill this important data gap will ultimately help lead to lasting solutions and contribute to a more equitable, sustainable U.S. food system.
That was Beth Feingold of the University at Albany. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, in partnership with the Association of American Colleges and Universities. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. While you're there, subscribe to our podcast or any of the other WAMC or National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org, and you can find us on Twitter at @TBOOKnowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org. ¶¶